Hachette Audio presents Eversion, written by Alastair Reynolds, read by Harry Myers.
Physician, heal thyself. Luke chapter 4, verse 23. Chapter 1. Footsteps rescued me from my nightmare. They were approaching with urgency, hard soles thudding on old, creaking timbers. I came around seated at my writing desk, face pressed to the pages of my manuscript. I lifted my head and pinched at the gummy corners of my eyes. Pince-nez spectacles were before me on the desk, slightly askew where the force of my slumping forehead had borne down on them. I straightened them out, fixed them to my nose, and splashed water on my face from a cork-stoppered earthenware jar. The footsteps ceased. A knock sounded at the door, followed by the immediate sound of the door being eased ajar. "Come in, Mortlock," I said, swiveling in my seat, feigning the impression of being disturbed from innocent business. The tall, stooping midshipman bent his head and shoulders into the low-ceilinged cabin.
"How did you know it was me, Dr. Code?"
"You have a manner, Mortlock," I said pleasantly. "Everyone has a manner, and I remembered yours. Sooner or later, if we are not first shipwrecked, I expect I will know the manner of everyone on this vessel." I made a show of blotting the manuscript, even though the ink was hours dry on my last edition. I was in the process of closing the leather-bound covers when my eyes alighted on the little machine-engraved snuff-box that was still on the desk, open to reveal its contents. A cold horror of discovery shot through me. "How is that tooth?" I asked, a touch too hastily. Mortlock tugged down his scarf to touch the side of his jaw. It was still slightly swollen, but a good deal less inflamed than it had been 4 days ago when I had dealt with an abscess.
"Much better, Doctor. Sir, thank you very much. Turn about. Let me see your profile."
Mortlock did as he was instructed, affording me the precious seconds I needed to spirit the snuff box safely into a drawer. "Yes," I said, nodding. "Yes, very satisfactory. Continue with the tincture I gave you, and you should feel a steady improvement over the coming days." I looked at him over my spectacles. "Your company is always welcome, Mortlock. But is there something else besides the abscess?"
"It's the Coronel, sir. He's had a bit of a bump out on deck. Out cold he was, and now he's back with us, but he's striking out, wriggling and cussing in that native tongue of his.
Spanish is, I believe, the term for it, or at least the form of it endemic in New Spain." I relaxed slightly, believing that Mortlock had made nothing of the snuff-box nor its sudden disappearance. "What was the nature of the injury?"
"A block came down on his bonnet, hard as you like. Knocked him clean to the floor."
Mortlock made an emphatic chopping motion.
"We were changing tack, looking for that gap in the cliff, and the Coronel just happened to be in the wrong spot when a rope snapped. There was a bit of blood, but his head hadn't gone all soft as if it had been stoved in, so we thought he'd be all right if we just sat him up and let him have a nip of rum, sir."
I shuddered to think of the poor man's injury being poked and prodded by men who could barely read, let alone perform a competent diagnosis. "Bring him to me immediately, Mortlock."
"What is it, do you reckon?"
"I dare not speculate. But if he has suffered concussion, even in the absence of a skull fracture, there may be elevated intracerebral pressure." I reached beneath the desk for one of several elegant boxes which I'd brought with me. "All haste now, Mortlock," I continued, raising my voice spiritedly. "And be so kind as to communicate to Mr. Murgatroyd or Captain von Voot himself that it would be extremely helpful if the ship were to maintain a constant heading for the next half an hour."
"The master might grumble about that, Doctor, if it slows down our search."
I nodded somberly. He is bound to, but I shall remind him that it is his man-at-arms that I shall be striving to save. Mortlock departed, his footsteps ringing away. I sat still for a moment, collecting myself, and reflecting on that irony that I had first hidden one pretty box and then disclosed another. Both were finely made things, both in their way vital to my work. The box I had concealed contained opium snuff, self-administered with the intention of dulling myself into dreamless oblivion. The other held a French-made trephination brace of impeccable manufacture, but which I had never had cause to use on a living subject. I feared, no, hoped, that this state of affairs was about to change. "Are you ready for this, Silas?" I asked myself aloud. "Your first real test on this voyage? Your first real test of any sort?" I opened the lid on the trephination brace, imagining the college examiners casting their doubtful gazes upon my hesitant efforts. Stern-faced men in black, men with London manners, veterans of troubled voyages and bloody engagements, men for whom cutting and sawing was as effortless as breathing, men to whom screams were merely the peculiar music of their profession. What hubris was it that made me think that I could ever join their ranks? I was a West Countryman without connections, a poor provincial surgeon out of Plymouth, but of Cornish blood, as I reminded all who would listen. 44, and therefore long past the age at which most surgeons made their first voyage. A mere assistant surgeon, yet the only surgeon of any kind, on a fifth-rate sloop under a Dutch captain. The captain was kind, but his ship was old, his crew tired, their provisions threadbare, and the terms of our charter questionable in the extreme. This was how I meant to make my way. The gleaming parts of the trephination brace waited in snug recesses of purple felt. The metalwork was engraved, the handles of ebony. Such beautiful artistry for such brutal ends. My fingers quivered as I reached to extract the drill-like components. Suppressing a spasm of shame, I retrieved the snuffbox and took a hasty pinch in order to settle my nerves and banish the last traces of the nightmare. It was a habit that was becoming all too familiar, especially as we ventured further north along the Norwegian coast. Matters had worsened since leaving Bergen, with the nightmare repeating itself with increasing regularity. I had been taking more and more snuff to counter its effects, with diminishing success. The nightmares were like nothing I had endured before setting foot on Demeter. In them, I found myself staggering along a barely lit stone passage, clad in hood or mask or helmet, gripped by the terrible intimation that I myself was dead, merely a shambling corpse with empty sockets and grinning jaw. I could not identify the cause of these torments, other than to speculate that being confined for long hours in my cabin, with only books, potions, and surgical instruments for company, my mind had become unhealthily focused on the thin membrane which separates the living from the dead. My one hope lay in the failure, or should I say abandonment, of our expedition. Perhaps, as we scoured endless dismal miles of Norwegian coastline, looking for a glimpse of something that only one man truly believed to exist, and he not exactly the most sober or reliable among our number. And as the days grew colder, the seas rougher, the ice more abundant, the stores more depleted, the ship more worn out, the general morale weaker, the lugubrious Dutchman more openly sceptical of our chances, perhaps I might yet be saved by our turning home. It was a coward's hope, as well I knew. Yet in the grip of the equal miseries of seasickness and dysentery, not to mention every other common hardship of seaborne life, I should gladly have proclaimed my cowardice to all who would listen. I had hidden the snuffbox again by the time the injured coronel was brought down to my room. In those minutes I had also prepared the main table, sweeping it free of books, journals, and manuscript pages, and made sure my other instruments and remedies were to immediate hand. Coronel Ramos was in a state of considerable agitation as the midshipmen press-ganged him into the room, for even in his confused condition, he was bigger and stronger than any of them. It took four to get him onto the table, and they had a struggle to make good his restraints as he thrashed and twisted like some muscular eel. "He was unarmed while agitated?" I asked Mortlock, who was one of the four assistants and the only midshipman I knew by name.
"That's the lucky part, Doctor. He's always polishing that flintlock of his, and he had it in one hand in a cleaning pipe in the other when the block came down, and it made him drop the pistol. Mr. Murgatroyd got hold of it before it got washed through the gunnels, but I think if he hadn't, and the Colonel still had it in his hand, you'd be digging a bullet out of one of us."
"Let us be thankful for small mercies, then." Since the wound was on the back of his head, I had dictated that they secure him to the table face down. He had bled profusely, so I swabbed the affected area as gently and thoroughly as I could, being careful not to depress the bone until I had determined to my satisfaction that there was no serious fracture. My examination was helped by the fact that Ramos was quite bald, not just about the crown, but around his whole blocky, boulder-shaped head. Some hair still grew, but he shaved it away each morning, sparing only his beard and moustache, which he maintained with the same devotion shown to his armaments.
"It doesn't look too bad," Mortlock offered.
"There is no penetration of the skull, nor any fracture that I can detect. He is made of stern stuff, our Coronel. The impact has knocked his brain about, causing his present distress. There is likely a build-up of pressure, blood or cerebral fluid, which must be relieved by means of trephination." Mortlock's eyes drifted to the exquisite French brace poised in its now open box.
"You're going to drill into him with that froggy thing? It's the only thing that will save him."
I looked to the four men who had come in with the Coronel. "It will likely cause him some discomfort, and you must be ready for that. But I'm confident that the procedure will work if we proceed speedily." I pushed my spectacles back up my nose, countering their habit of drifting to the tip. Rolling up my sleeves, I took the brace and settled myself into the most comfortable and stable position for the procedure. Master Topolsky and Milady Cosseal burst into the room without warning. The former was a cloud of black, the latter an apparition in yellow. I glanced up from my preparations, squinting through a loose lock of hair.
"What is this?" asked Topolsky, heavily clothed, wet and windswept from being out on deck.
"A medical emergency, Master Topolsky."
"The doctor's going to drill into him," Mortlock explained, with as much eagerness as if he had just graduated to the position of assistant surgeon. "His brain can't breathe in and out, see, so it's squeezing his thoughts."
"A most commendable summary," said Milady Cosseal, her fingers steepled. "I expect Mr. Mortlock will soon be composing the standard monograph on the subject." Mortlock looked at me doubtfully.
"Is the young gentlewoman being sarcastic again, Doctor?"
I nodded sympathetically at the midshipman, who was straining every muscle to hold Ramos still. "Pay her no heed, Mortlock. You are doing very well."
"Is there need for this?"
asked Topolsky, looming over the table.
"The Coronel is a hale man with the common vigor of his kind. He just needs a little rest, not to be drilled into like a brandy cask."
His tone sharpened.
"We still have need of him, Code."
"And my purpose is to ensure that he remains at our disposal, Master." Ramos muttered something from the table. It sounded like trece to me, the Spanish for 13. He was not a true-born Spaniard, but a citizen of New Spain. He had been a soldier, hence his title, but he now owed his allegiance to no army or king, and offered his services for hire to men such as Topolsky. I knew very little about him, for Ramos was a taciturn man, quite the opposite of his boisterous employer. But we had spoken now and then, usually in the quiet moments between watches, when one of us might encounter the other on deck, pensively watching the sea. Some political or religious difficulty, more than likely the same thing, had forced him to leave the Americas. I understood a little of it, piecing together such crumbs of biography as Ramos chanced to offer during our nearly silent communions. Turning against his father, Ramos had developed sympathies for the independence movement led by the Jesuit Hidalgo.
"Better men than I have found themselves before the Court of Inquisition," Ramos had confided to me. "But I had the means to leave, and they did not. It does not make me brave, merely astute."
Now this softly spoken giant, Ramos said that he owed his size and strength to his mother, who was of Criollo descent, lay on my table, whimpering and foaming at the mouth. I was glad that his face was averted, facing the floor, because I could not have stood to look into his eyes as I began to work the brace.
"Trece,"
Ramos murmured. Then, after a pause,
"Cinco."
I applied firm but steady pressure on the brace while turning the handle at a slow, constant rate. The three-tipped bit was already biting into bone, etching a coin-sized groove. Mortlock kept glancing at my work, then tearing his gaze away, while the three other midshipmen seemed incapable of mustering even a glance. I did not blame them for that. Trepanation was hardly something to be encountered in the normal life of the sailor.
"A question of terminology, if I may."
Sweat was already in my eyes. It was the first time I had found my cabin anything other than intolerably cold since leaving Bergen. I paused in my work and pushed my hair and spectacles back again. "By all means, Milady Cossille."
"La Vigilia,"
Ramos said, on a note of rising concern.
"La Vigilia! La Vigilia! They..."
"Concerning the procedure you are employing." Milady Cossille still had her fingers steepled, tapping their tips against her lips between utterances. She had perfect lips, I thought. Not even the brush of Gainsborough could have captured their fullness.
"I have encountered the term trepanation as well as trephination. Would you presume that the two forms are etymologically related?"
I resumed my drilling. "I cannot say that I have given the matter much consideration."
"But still, would you presume?"
"I suppose I might." Even with my eyes focused on the drilling site, I still detected Milady Cossille's gleeful response to my answer. She skipped forward, clapping delightedly, her feathers bouncing jauntily before re-steepling her fingers.
"Then you would presume incorrectly, Dr. Code. The two forms are etymologically quite distinct. I am surprised you were not aware of this."
I continued with my work. "Do enlighten us, milady." Ramos said,
"Trece. Cinco. Trece. Cinco. La Vigilia de Piedra. La Vigilia."
"Trepanation derives from trepanon, which in turn derives from the Greek trupanon, meaning an instrument for boring. Trephination, or trephine, derives instead from the Latin, in particular trephine, or three ends. Whether the latter term was first coined by Fabricius ab Aquapendente or John Woodall a century later is a question yet to be settled."
I looked up from my work and nodded. "Thank you, milady. I am sure we are all most enlightened."
"Never mind enlightenment," Topolsky said, leaning very close into the drill site.
The Russian was a stout, pot-bellied man of about 40, with a wide, cherubic face, densely circumscribed by a curly mass of beard, sideburns, and fringe. He had the sort of twinkling, searching, jocular eyes that suggested an agreeableness of temperament lamentably absent in the man himself.
"Will he live? We need this brute code. Our expedition cannot proceed without him. He may not be learned, and his manners distinctly those of the New World rather than the old, but who among us understands the placement of gunpowder like the Coronel?
I agree entirely, I said. And if you value him as much as you say, you might refrain from projecting spittle into the wound site.
Topolsky swore at me in Russian, his lips largely hidden behind the prodigious eruption of his beard, which was as voluminous and roomy as Bramos's was neat and manicured. His hair glistened and smelled faintly of perfumed oils. Regaining something of his usual composure, he continued,
"Your reputation is satisfactory, Code. I only wish that this were not the time to put it to the gravest test."
"In my experience, Master, serious accidents rarely happen on a convenient schedule." Suddenly, I felt the opposition to the brace lessen as I bored through the last, sliver-like layer of bone. I had an image in my mind's eye. The tip of a drill bursting through the underside of a layer of ice into the dark water beneath. Ice as bone, water as dura and brain. "We are through. Master, if you might assist, that small implement like a sugar spoon, I must lever away the bone fragment. Had there been more time, I might have attempted to form an osteoplastic flap, but..." Abandoning my commentary, I put away the brace and closed my fist around the tool Topolsky had passed me. To my immense relief, the coin-sized section of bone levered away willingly, and with it came an immediate expulsion of thick, sticky blood from a severe epidural hematoma.
"It's like raspberry jam, Doctor," Mortlock declared excitedly.
I smiled at him. "But perhaps a tad less palatable, even with your mother's best bread and butter." I watched Ramos for a minute, until I had convinced myself that there was a definite easing in his distress. "That must work," I declared. "It is, in any case, all I can do. To go beneath the juror would kill him. Medicine has done what it can, gentlemen. The rest of his fate is between Ramos and his god."
"His god?" Topolsky muttered contemptuously. "Can you imagine such a debased deity? Half papist nightmare, half whatever Inca savagery came down to him from his mother."
Laughter lines creased the skin around his eyes and mouth as they did when he was pleased with an observation he had either uttered or was about to utter.
"Better no god at all, I might venture."
The expulsion of blood was easing. I did not think there was continued bleeding under the skull, although it would likely be many hours or days until we could be assured of his survival. Longer still before we knew that Ramos would recover entirely. I was not so sanguine, for I had seen and read about the lingering influence of concussion and other maladies of the brain on otherwise healthy men. If he carried only the physical scars of this day, he would be fortunate.
"Will you pop that bit of bone back into his head, Doctor?"
"No, Mortlock, it would only become infected. But the hole is as small as I could make it. When I am sure that the pressure has been relieved, I shall close up the wound with stitches." The unwelcome imagery of my recurring dream sprang to mind unbidden. The stone passage, the hood about me, my own face reduced to a hollow skull. I winced it away as one winces away a sour aftertaste. "I think the Coronel will consider himself fortunate to have come through this day, even if he must live with a weak spot on the back of his head."
"A commendable effort," Milady Cossil said.
She was dressed all in yellow, with a short-brimmed hat that seemed mostly made of yellow feathers.
"Perhaps there is something to be said for our provincial schools of medicine, after all."
"I shall be sure to convey your estimation to my tutors in Plymouth. Thank you also for the lesson in etymology, which could not have been more timely. Do I have that right? I sometimes forget which one is to do with words and which is to do with insects." She smiled patronizingly.
"You have the right of it for once."
"I still say he'd have been shipshape with a bit of rest," Topolsky complained,
eyeing the now much less agitated form on my table. Ramos was still murmuring, but now his words slipped out of him drowsily and without any conveyance of inner turmoil.
Trece. Cinco. La Vigilia de Piedra.
Without this intervention, he would have been dead within the hour, Master. Now he has a fighting chance.
Good. Then if you're done with your infernal sawing, I suppose I can ask the captain to resume our northerly progression?
Far be it from me to interfere in the priorities of the expedition, Master. Dare I inquire, exactly how far into the ice floes will we sail before giving up on your quarry?
Concern yourself with potions, Doctor. Leave the work of discovery to those of us who have the imagination for it.
That I shall gladly do. Topolsky and Milady Cossille departed. I told the midshipmen that they had been of great assistance, but were now free to go about their duties. Since Demeter would surely be about to resume turning and turning about, zigzagging her way north, I presumed that they would be needed on deck, assisting in the great coordinated dance of rope and canvas which made us sail. Mortlock lingered after the other three had gone.
"I'm off duty now, Doctor, so if you'd like someone to sit with the Coronel and keep an eye on him, I'd be more than willing."
"That is very kind of you, Mortlock." His gaze fell upon the restful giant still bound to the table.
"He's a quiet, brooding sort of cove, isn't he? The men said he was aloof to start with, like he was better than the rest of us. Perhaps he is. But out of all of them that came with Master Topolsky, I think I like him the best."
"I venture our opinions are not entirely unlike." Mortlock put on a half-smile.
"Is that your way of saying you agree with me, Doctor, but you can't quite come out and say it?"
I reflected on my answer as I set about cleaning and packing away the parts of the trepanation brace. "You have the right of it, as Milady Cossille might have said. Now, will you help me turn the Coronel? I fancy he will be more comfortable on his back." After he had assisted me, Mortlock slid one of my chairs across the timbers and sat down in it wearily without waiting on invitation. He was about my age and height. There all essential similarities ended. Mortlock was a burly, red-headed Yorkshireman. I was from whippet-thin Cornish mining stock. Mortlock had been at sea since he was a boy and survived action, mutiny, flogging, shipwrecking, and two bouts of scurvy. Since coming aboard, I had merely been afflicted by racking seasickness and a near-constant dread of imminent catastrophe. In my mind, every creak and groan of the ship presaged the splitting of her fabric from bow to stern. I was not made for the sea, and all the men knew it to one degree or another. But, of all of them, only Mortlock seemed not to judge me for my failing.
"Concerning her ladyship, Doctor, and I don't mean to speak out of turn here, but she's a bit of an ass, isn't she?"
"An ass, Mortlock? Pardon my French, I mean. It is quite all right. And in point of fact, I see no reason to find fault with your assessment." Mortlock relaxed into the chair.
"Why has she got it in for you all the time?"
"I think that is merely her manner, Mortlock. I imagine she was raised to consider herself among inferiors at all times. Doubtless life has reinforced this admirable opinion of herself at every turn from cradle to college. She has never had the slightest cause to be disabused of it. There may even be a grain of truth in it. I do not doubt that she is intelligent and well-schooled."
"I didn't go to a school at all."
"Then my point is proved. With no schooling, save for the humble education you have received at sea, you have proved yourself a far more agreeable companion than Milady Cossille will ever be. Granted, you are not so fair to the eye, nor so free of blemishes, nor do you deport yourself with such maddening—" I curtailed my train of thought before I blushed at him. "But we must make allowances. Master Topolsky picked his expedition partners himself, and we must strive to see the value in each of them." Mortlock leaned back in the chair, reached for a shelf and began leafing through the papers I'd shoved from the table.
"Did you know of her before you came aboard?"
"As she is at pains to remind me, I am a provincial surgeon from the West Country,
while my Lady Cossille moves in well-connected intellectual and academic circles in London. I am informed that she is on as equally agreeable terms with the likes of Byron as she is with men such as Davy. Our spheres, dare I say it, do not greatly intersect.
First it's circles, then it's spheres. Make your mind up, Doctor.
He scratched at the rough red skin on the back of his neck.
I just don't understand why she needles you all the time. It's like you offended her in a past life.
I am equally at a loss, Mortlock, I said wearily. I can only suppose that Milady Cossille sees it as her gainful mission to occasionally improve another soul. Regrettably, for the duration of this expedition, I am the target of that undoubted altruism. But enough of our redoubtable etymologist. I glared at him as he continued rummaging through my papers. Can I help, or are you quite content to dig into my writings on your own?
Oh, you're all right, Doctor. I was just hoping to get ahead of the others, you see.
It was my fault. When Mortlock had come to me with his abscess, I had allowed him to quiz me on my progress with the manuscript, and at length had even allowed him to glance through the next couple of chapters, going so far as to gauge his opinion on one or two troublesome points of narrative. It had been my way of taking his mind off the treatment. But Mortlock, being an open, trusting sort of soul, had taken this as immediate license to treat my papers as his own. I think perhaps we must draw a line under the narrative. Mortlock looked up, as stricken as if he had just read his own death warrant.
You can't do that, Dr. Cord. There'll be, well, I shan't say mutiny, because that's a black word on any ship, even a privateer like Demeter. But there'll be ructions if the midshippers don't get to hear the next part.
Ructions is the word you seek. But surely the midshippers haven't heard any part of it. You are the only man of that station who has come to the captain's table. Mortlock scratched around the diminishing swelling of his abscess.
That isn't quite true. I hope you don't mind, but I've been memorising bits of it as much as I can, leastways. And then going over it again when I'm down below.
He fidgeted in the chair, as restless as any boy summoned to their headmaster.
I didn't mean anything wrong by it, but a lot of the men down there can't read or write, and a story takes them out of things. I tried them on Gulliver's Travels, but they said they liked your story more, so I kept on with it.
I see. I held my silence for a few seconds, not entirely out of some mean enjoyment of Mortlock's discomfort. You say they find some interest in it?
Oh, yes. Mortlock leaned in eagerly. Especially that part about the ship with steam in its belly.
A steam-driven ship is no more than a logical progression of current developments.
And the thing the men are sailing towards. You can't leave them not knowing what it is, Doctor.
Would that the question were entirely settled in my own mind, Mortlock. I am afraid that is not quite the case. When I read a passage to the captain's gathering, I am seldom more than a chapter or two ahead of it in my own process of composition. I gestured at the papers he held. That is the difficulty. Between you and me, I am torn about the direction of the narrative. Mortlock turned to the start of the manuscript. His finger moved along the line at the top of the page.
The stone, he paused. Vigil?
Vigil, I corrected him. The Stone Vigil. That is the title I have finally settled upon. Mortlock read on.
The Stone Vigil, or The Edifice in Ice. A romance by Dr. Silas Cord.
He nodded his appreciation.
That's got a nice ring to it, it has.
Next to us, Ramos murmured,
La Figilia de Piedra.
He approves, Mortlock said, laughing. I wondered what he was coming out with when you were drilling him. That's just the Spanish for your book, isn't it?
I nodded through a faint uneasiness. You have a keen ear for languages.
It comes with seafaring, I suppose. I've heard every tongue under the sun. I can effing blind in half of them, too.
He gathered the manuscript pages back together and returned them to the shelf.
Well, I said I'd keep an eye on him if you like, and I meant it. And I promise I won't go peeping into the chapters you haven't read out to us.
Earnestly, he added,
but you got to keep going with it. For the men's sake, if not the rest of us. They'll have my guts for gibbets if I make them go back to Gulliver's bloody travels. And we don't even speak about Robinson Crusoe.
I shall endeavour to. I smiled inwardly, not entirely unflattered by the thought that the men below, rough formed as their tastes undoubtedly were, preferred my scribblings to the efforts of Swift and Defoe. Although it must be understood that my surgical duties take priority at all times. Mortlock looked fondly upon Ramos, quiet again now.
We're a lucky ship, Captain Vonny says. I'm sorry for the Coronel that he was the one, but that'll be our one bit of bad luck out of the way now, mark my words.
For an intelligent man, Mortlock, you harbour a deplorable streak of superstition.
I'm afraid that's another thing that comes with being at sea, he replied, unapologetically. As you'll find out if you stick with it long enough.
I doubt very much that my career at sea will be of any great duration, I replied. Chapter 2. Content that Mortlock would keep watch over my patient, I gathered my deck clothes, putting on as many layers as was feasible before facing the savagery of the wind and waves. I was buttoning my coat when lightning flickered against my cabin windows. I waited for the roll of thunder to arrive, but the sounds of the ship must have muffled it. There is always lightning, I murmured to myself, as if some deep truth lay buried in those words. Exactly how far north we had come was neither my professional concern nor my private interest. The last accurate point of reference I committed to memory was when we stopped in Bergen to augment our supplies, but we had been sailing up the Norwegian coast for a further 10 days since then, making between 40 and 60 miles of northerly progress in each 24 hours. Our course was seldom direct, though, since the wind was coming at us from the Arctic Circle, and Captain von Voot was obliged to plot a laborious, zigzagging route. I noted the changes in the heading and tilt of the ship the first 20 or so times they happened. There was always a commotion of shouts and footfalls above my cabin as sails were reorganized. Eventually, like all the rhythms and routines of maritime life, these disturbances dropped beneath the threshold of conscious observation, except when they caused me to lose my footing or tip a candle across my desk. That we were indeed far to the north of Bergen, perhaps 400 or 500 miles, was abundantly obvious as soon as I ascended the ladder, the companion ladder, I should call it, that brought me onto the top or quarterdeck. The wind knifed against me with an escalating, impersonal malice as I went up rung by rung, until the full, fierce force of it was striking my whole body. The planking was icy. The wheel was nearer to the stern than the ladder, so I had to resist the wind's efforts to send me skidding bodily along the quarterdeck. By this point, though, I had learned to emulate the stable, splay-footed stance of the older hands, not just because this habitual posture aided progress on a rocking, slippery deck, but because it helped against seasickness, to which I had already proven abundantly susceptible. The men had found it amusing that of all the maladies which could befall their surgeon, I was afflicted with the one for which there was no ready remedy except time. I made my way along the wind-whipped quarterdeck. I spied 3 men standing close together by the wheel. The captain was one of them, Topolsky another. No other man had quite his build, but the third was not readily identifiable. I did not think it was Milady Cosseel, nor one of the senior officers, so, with Ramos excluded, that left one of the 2 other men brought aboard by Topolsky, Monsieur Dupin or Herr Brucker, both of whom were suitably alike in stature. I continued my cautious advance, allowing my gaze to lift to the sails and rigging and the celestial depths beyond. It was 10 at night, and the skies were clear, still, and transparent. Polaris sat high above us, and a full moon transformed the ship into a gleaming, spectral blue vision. Ghostly, except where there was a smudge of orange from a brazier, a lantern, or a wavering pipe cupped close to the mouth. Off the port side stood an immensity of dark, foam-crested water, continuing all the way to a black horizon. On the starboard side, to our east, loomed a continuous wall of sea cliffs, craggy and barren, underscored by a drool of surf. We were about a mile off these cliffs, and had been sailing alongside them, allowing for the zigzagging course of the ship, ever since we had departed Bergen. Occasionally there had been an inlet or an island to interrupt the tedium, but the overall impression was of some dreary iteration of the same pattern, like a roll of wallpaper fashioned into a continuous, nauseating strip. I wondered how even the keenest navigator could be confident of our position now. Von Voot had shown me his charts in the days after Bergen. They started off quite accurately, with each tiny feature of the coast mapped and named, but then became progressively less detailed with increasing latitude. He had stopped identifying islands and inlets some days ago, relying instead on measurements of stars and his consultation of chronometers and tables. That was easier said than done on a ship in rough waters, often under clouded skies. I came within easy speaking range of the three men and identified Dupin as the third member of the party. Von Voot had his hands on the wheel, Topolsky next to him, the captain's weather-worn features illuminated by the meagre glow from his pipe. Had Rembrandt painted him, he could easily have been some stoic, biblical patriarch of immense and improbable age. The captain was about 50, but looked older, as men who had lived at sea often did. He had a beard and a prominent, ledge-like moustache, stiffened like the bristles of an old and dependable broom.
"How fares Colonel Ramos, Dr. Code? Master Topolsky tells me you drilled into his head."
The captain's English was beyond reproach, but he still softened his S's, fares becoming fairsh, his becoming hish, and so on. "A simple trepanation which I hope will have the desired outcome."
"We went at it like a man who wants very much to justify an expenditure," Topolsky complained to the captain.
"I'm sure we can rely on the doctor's good judgment."
"I shall be glad to, provided he does not insist on drilling into the rest of us."
Topolsky was much shorter and broader than the captain.
"I have the constitution of a Cossack wrestler,"
he had assured me early in our acquaintance, when I had noted how easily he became out of breath climbing up and down companion ladders. Yes, I thought, but only if that hypothetical wrestler had spent a year indulging in enormous feasts and heroic bouts of idleness. Perhaps his blood was indeed Cossack, but there was so much about Topolsky that was bluster and misdirection, I took none of his assertions as proven fact. He spoke English and French very well, and had clearly spent time in London and Paris. He only ever spoke Russian to curse, though he often alluded to his familiarity with the imperial court.
"Ah, yes, as Catherine herself once confided to me," or, "it reminds me of an exquisite objet d'art shown to me by Peter himself in the private annex of the Hermitage," and that sort of thing.
Attempt to pin him down on any of it, though, such as when he was last in Russia, and what had caused him to seek his fame elsewhere, and the topic was quickly and skillfully dodged. This much I could be sure of. He was wealthy enough to fund this expedition, but not so wealthy or generous with his money as to fund it lavishly. The ship was fifth rate, by definition. In mutual arrangement between Von Voot and Topolsky, she ran with a very small crew, so that the men were at constant risk of being overworked. Costs had been cut in 100 miserly ways, from the provision of the cheapest sort of salted beef to second-hand sailcloth to my surgical supplies. I was also one of those expense-saving measures. A surgeon, but not one of great repute, nor one who could afford to dictate his terms of employment. I, in other words, was as meagerly provisioned as the beef. "We have resumed our course north," I asked. Von Voot smiled enough to lift the stiff, horizontal extremities of his moustache. "We will make a navigator of you yet, Dr. Code." I would take credit for my observation, but it takes very little learning to notice that Norway is off to our right, to starboard, I should say. I nodded at one of the other men standing near the wheel. "Has Monsieur Dupin spied your objective, master?"
"I have not," Dupin answered. He did not look at me, nor otherwise shift his gaze, for Dupin had his eye to a small, dainty spyglass. He had the spyglass aimed ahead of us, and a little to the right, fixed on the line of cliffs about a mile north of Demeter. Raymond Dupin was a very young man, perhaps the youngest of any of us save the greenest midshippers. I believed him to be about 20, but in his appearance there was nothing to suggest that he was anything other than an earnest, slightly sullen schoolboy. Prodigious tufts of yellow hair erupted from beneath the woolen cap he wore against the weather. His face was long and sharp-edged, with a chin that could split flint and cheekbones like razors. He was all shadow and light, like a sketch of a man rather than the finished work. Not a hint of beard hair showed anywhere around his mouth or in the line of his jaw. His deep, close-set eyes were as cold and grey-green as the waters in which we now sailed. In service to Topolsky, he had come aboard as the expedition's private cartographer and authority on all matters of navigation. Naturally, Von Voot had experience of his own to call on, as well as such charts and instruments that were already aboard Demeter. These resources had clearly been deemed insufficient for the expedition's needs, and so Dupin had his own spyglasses, sextants, clocks, and so on, all of impeccable quality. There, at least, no expense had been spared, as well as trunks of maps, charts, and almanacs. These items he guarded like crown jewels, clutching them jealously to his chest if another man, especially one of the regular crew, should show the slightest inclination to touch them or even look too closely. The fine instruments, some of which had undoubtedly been furnished by the other member of the party, Herr Brucher, came and went from his plush-lined cases like infants being raised and lowered from cribs. In that respect, I could find no fault in him. I was no less protective of my braces, knives, and bone saws. Both of us were born to a trade, and both of us knew the value of our implements. Mine were for dividing and suturing flesh, his sliced and ligatured distance and time. "What exactly," I began, "what exactly is it that we are looking for?" "The fissure," Topolsky said. Then, with unmasked irritation, "Code, have you been completely oblivious to our conversations across all the evenings when we have gathered?" "I was merely minding my own business, master." "The doctor has enough concerns of his own without us adding to them," Von Voit remarked.
"Yes, I suppose it must be a very taxing business, thinking up a fairy story."
Von Voit glanced at the other man with a surprising asperity.
"I did not mean that. The doctor writes only in his spare time such little as he has, and I know that the men find it a pleasant distraction from the immediate concerns of our voyage. Even Milady Cashiel takes some pleasure in it."
"Yes," I said, since the objectionable etymologist was not about. "The same sort of pleasure as the hound takes in the fox."
"Criticism too much for you?" Topolsky asked. "Perhaps writing is not your vocation after all."
"A man may have two vocations,"
Von Voot mused. Topolsky did not like my narrative, but his objection to it was of a much more transparent nature than that of Milady Cosseel. When we first set out, Topolsky had been lord of the dinner table. He had many stories he wished to declaim, and for a little while he had been gifted with an attentive, if skeptical, audience. I posed no challenge to his oratory, and so he liked me. His eyes twinkled,
the sherry flowed, the cigars were consumed, the tall tales encouraged. But as the wind put more leagues behind us, the shine had gradually rubbed off his boasting and name-dropping. There was a sameness to it, a certain predictability, as if we had all heard the stories many times over. They were the sort of account which tended to conclude with Master Topolsky leaning back and declaiming,
"Of course I was proved right in the end." Or, "Naturally, if they had listened to me, none of that would have happened."
And various permutations thereof. When, during a lull, I was persuaded to read aloud from my Romance in Progress, which Murgatroyd and one or two of the other men were aware of, I had displaced Topolsky in the general affections of those evening gatherings. That had not been my intention, but now I suffered the daily consequence of that reckless impertinence. How dare I be the more popular dinner speaker? You may be relieved, Master, to hear that I am minded to discontinue the narrative.
Mortlock would have me continue it, that bumpkin thinks a brain is the same as a lung.
He tapped a finger against his nose as he prepared to offer me some shrewd advice.
I would value his opinion a little less highly if I were you, Code. He is a man of little learning and even less discernment. Choose your confidants more carefully.
I shall keep that in mind, Master.
Besides, your fancies already strain our credulity overmuch. Ships that sail by steam, cannons that fire volleys without being reloaded, and paintings that compose themselves by light alone.
He turned to the cartographer.
What do you think's next, Dupin? Men bestriding the air? A picnic on the moon?
Dupin grunted his uninterest. He was still sweeping the cliff, angling his spyglass at a slowly moving point about 2 miles ahead of us.
Let us speak of our position, Captain von Voot said.
With one hand still on the wheel, he used the other to jab his pipe down at the angled chart table positioned at the wheel's side. It was an improvised affair, somewhat like a lectern, with a sheet of glass that could be clamped across any open map or set of tables to protect them from the elements. Suspended above the lectern was a lantern, bucking and swaying with the wind and the motion of the ship.
"Where do we think we are?" I asked.
Von Voot tapped the pipe stem against the glass, and by implication against the portion of the chart immediately beneath it.
"My conviction is we have just shortly passed the 68th degree of latitude, putting our position approximately here. Monsieur Dupin, on the other hand, contends that we are still some way south of the aforementioned line of latitude, no more than 67½ degrees north."
67 degrees and 22 minutes of latitude,
Dupin said mechanically.
I wish I could offer an opinion either way, I said. All I know is that it is cold, and the sun seems to reach a little less high in the sky from day to day. But I suppose it does that every winter.
The difficulty, Topolsky went on, is this. It is agreed, quite agreed, that in all matters where a decision must be taken, our excellent captain has the commanding authority. That is quite beyond disputation. But the difficulty...
Then there is no difficulty, I interrupted. If the captain considers the 68th degree to be the absolute limit of our northerly progress, then that is his decision.
But the difficulty, Topolsky persisted, the very grave difficulty, is that since we cannot agree upon our position, we do not have the luxury of deferring to the captain's unquestioned authority. Since it is not yet a settled matter that we are indeed north of the 68th degree, the conditions for the captain's decision, however that should fall, have not been activated.
With no disrespect to Monsieur Dupin, ought not the observations taken by Captain von Voot and his ablest men take precedence? The captain knows his ship and his instruments. He knows these waters well.
I have sailed close to these shores, said Van Voot, who was too modest not to offer a clarification. But never as close to these cliffs as we are now.
Monsieur Dupin is quite confident in his observations, Topolsky said. Aren't you, Dupin?
Dupin lowered his spyglass momentarily. Despite the cold, a sheen of sweat showed on his brow and along the sharp ridges of his cheekbones.
I have sufficient confidence.
In these matters, I ventured, it may be wise to cleave to the precautionary principle. We have two sets of measurements, and neither can be said to be more trustworthy than the other. The captain knows his instruments and his methods, and we must presume no inferior capability on Monsieur Dupin's behalf. Von Voot jammed his pipe into his mouth and used both hands to make an adjustment to the wheel. From somewhere beneath the decking, I felt the groan of rope and timber as his intentions were communicated to the rudder. A few clipped commands had men scurrying about the sails and rigging, fearless of the wind, ice, or the tumultuous waters below. Von Voot spoke out of the corner of his mouth, the pipe waggling with his words.
Would you suggest that we split the difference between the positions?
No, I would suggest that we treat your reading as the one to act upon, not because it is more inherently believable, but because it is the one that places us furthest north and therefore in the greatest theoretical peril. Have you any incentive to exaggerate our northerly progress?
I have not, Von Voot said. In fact, I shall be denying myself a bonus if we do not locate the objective Master Topolsky Sheikhs. If I did not believe my reading, I should be very content for us to sail on.
He crunched his jaw down tighter on his pipe, a habit which made me wince.
But I do believe it, unfortunately. And even if I did not have the evidence of my measurements, there is that.
He was staring ahead in a sudden and deliberate fashion, like a dog that has just spied a rabbit. Something new and cold sparking in his eyes as if a few wayward chips of the moon had lodged themselves within his pupils.
Ice, he said.
We have seen ice before, Topolsky said.
Small pieces of it no threat to us, but that ice is a mile off and there's a lot of it.
Is it serious enough for us to turn around?
Not just yet, Dr. Code. We can sail between the icebergs. They're only about the size of a house. But there will be bigger ones. There are always bigger ones.
I shivered. It was one thing to confront my own fears of destruction at sea. I had no doubt that many of them were irrational or wildly amplified. But it was another to stand next to a man such as Von Voot and feel a breath of his own fear, and know that it was well deserved. Dupin spoke.
I see it.
The ice? Topolsky asked.
No. Not the ice.
His hand shook on the spyglass.
The fissure.
Topolsky took the spyglass, lifting it to his eye with similarly trembling hands. He aimed it at the cliff, sliding the smallest tube in and out to adjust focus.
Where, Dupin, where?
Dupin reached over and steadied the spyglass.
A little nearer, about there.
I don't see anything.
It is not obvious.
Then help me, for pity's sake.
Look for an irregularity in the line of surf.
An irregularity?
Von Voot unclamped the sheet of glass on the table and drew out one of the drawings that had come aboard with Topolsky. He held it aloft under the lantern, comparing the sketched profile of the cliffs with the faint, moonlit apparition before us. As the lantern moved, so the drawing seemed to breathe in and out, as if etched onto the skin of some living organism.
I think you have your fissure, Master Topolsky.
I fancied I could see something where they were focusing their attention. A break in the surf, as if a pen had stuttered while scratching out a line of white ink, and perhaps a suggestion of a declivity above it, a recess in the cliff. But my night vision was nothing to boast about. Generations of mining forebears had not gifted me any sort of exceptional faculty in that regard. I was all too aware that the brain was apt to deceive itself into seeing almost anything, if the desire was sufficient. Did I desire it, or did I not desire it? That was a different question.
It could just be a deep notch, I offered.
It's nothing of the sort, Topolsky said. Use your eyes, Doctor.
I am attempting to.
There is a clear break in the line of the cliff all the way to the summit. It's the fissure, the inlet, the defile, exactly as described.
Each second improves the correlation. Good grief, there's that skull-shaped outcropping on the near side, just as in the drawing. It is the very thing and practically in our grasp. By the morning we shall be through to the other side.
Some dim inkling of their intentions reached me.
You mean we're to sail through that gap? It looks rather on the narrow side.
We're a narrow ship code. Why else would I hire this fifth-rate sloop? No offense intended, Captain von Voot.
None taken, Master. It is true we are narrow across the beam. Our draft is shallow also, and we are copper-bottomed. That will serve us well.
We've passed many indentations in the coastline, I said. Fjords, too many to name. What makes this one significant? They must all have been sailed into at some point. Norwegians and Danemen must have been sailing these waters for 1,000 years. There can't be much left to be explored.
This is not the same, Gold.
Tell him, Captain. Von Voot sucked on his pipe for a few moments.
The fissure was not here when my charts were compiled. There was just a continuous cliff. That is how it must have been about 100 years ago.
I nodded.
And now? The cliff must have become worn away until there was just a thin wall separating the sea from the inland water. A dike of rock. It could have been like that for a long time, even as long ago as when these charts were made. No one would have known that there was a body of water on the other side.
Until the cliff collapsed, creating your fissure.
And exactly when that happened, no one could say. Not even Master Topolsky, except that it must have been before his drawings and charts were compiled.
Von Voot sucked some more on his pipe. He was calm at all times, but never more so than he was on deck at the wheel. The vagaries of weather and sea seemed to have no bearing on his degree of inward repose. I could not have believed any man could be more at home, and more fully at peace with himself, in their favourite chair, in the warmest, snuggest parlour, than this man at the wheel of his beloved ship.
They are quite recent, are they not, Master Topolsky?
No more than 10 years old, Topolsky said. The collapse of the sea cliff must have happened between 1 century and 10 years ago, but beyond that we can only speculate. Perhaps more will become clearer as we traverse the passage.
There is a hazard in that, I imagine?
Most certainly, von Voot answered. Then I trust that whatever is beyond that fissure is worth the risk to us?
We did not sail all this way just to look at cliffs, Code.
Then what is it?
We seek a construction, a stone-built edifice at the eastern limit of the inland body of water.
Topolsky scrutinized my expression.
Do not look so gloomy, man. It will make your fortune just as surely as it makes mine. Surely you are not afraid of a little adventure.
You speak as if this construction were already known to us.
Its existence is known to a select number of individuals, including society men and women of considerable fortune and even greater discretion. My sponsors, in other words. But they only know it because I brought word.
But you haven't been here before. If you had, you'd have known exactly where to find the fissure.
Intelligence came my way, Code.
Some calculation worked behind his eyes.
A crew sailed these waters. Being of an exploratory disposition, they ventured into the fissure. The unworthiness of their ship prevented them going any further, but it was sufficient for them to glimpse and chart the object of our interest.
And the name of this ship?
Europa. Though the name will mean as little to you as some minor bone or ligament does to me.
But if the men of Europa saw this edifice of which you speak, why have they not made their fortunes in place of you? Surely priority trumps all other concerns in matters of discovery.
A glimpse is not a discovery. They did not see enough to capitalize on their exploit. Better that the intelligence be traded to a man such as myself, with the means and connections to make the most of it.
Is this settled, Captain? I asked. We are really going through that fissure.
The matter will be decided when we have light, Von Voot answered. And if the passage is navigable, if I judge it so, then navigate it we shall.
I could not explain why an unaccountable dread had begun to fill me at the idea of threading that passage. But fill me it had.